Hello and welcome to another episode of Everything Digital Health. I'm Marcus Bohr, I'm a GP and specialist in digital health. And today I'm joined by Dave Powell, who is another clinician who's particularly interested in clinical user interfaces. And this is a hugely interesting area and something that Dave's done loads of work in. So Dave, introduce yourself and tell us a little bit about yourself and your work.
Hi, Marcus. Well, I qualified I got out of medical school in the late 90s, and I followed a career in HIV medicine, sexual health and HIV. And then in the early 2000, mid 2000s, around 2011-12, at the London Teaching Hospital I worked at, they introduced my first EHR, and it was their first EHR. And it was just a horrifying experience for me. I remember logging in, and the first drop down, I had to select my clinic. So they hadn't even thought about telling the computer what clinic I was running. And there were, no word of a lie, there were 67 drop downs, non-alphabetical. So they hadn't, wow. They hadn't put thought into it particularly. And I started sketching the EHR I wanted to use, because when you started using this EHR, and they haven't changed massively since.
No, they haven't.
2011. I'll never forget one of my patients, and it happens repeatedly since then. They'd kind of lean over and look at my screen, and they'd say, "Isn't it in there somewhere?" Because I'd be asking the same question that they'd been asked dozens of times before. And of course, it is in there somewhere, isn't it? That they've had a broken leg in 2016, or they've had, you know, a pneumonia in 2015. It is in there somewhere, but it is not in there intuitively, and it is not there saliently, is the point. And so the minute I start a consultation, and I've done thousands, you've done thousands, I am always on the back foot, unless they're a brand new patient, in which case, lovely, I can deal with the sort of software.
Yeah, I mean, those kind of things with the user interfaces are that they feel like they're simple things to fix, but actually the technical underpinnings of making them better has been made very hard. Like, I think the infrastructure is not there. So like, in an ideal world, we would have a register that's like an API of all the staff in the NHS. And that data source would provide developers with which clinic you work in. Like, that sort of data source would be absolutely game-changing for the people who are building systems. Let's assume that they want to make a good system. I think that the developers themselves do want to make good systems, but I think the commercial arrangements around the systems and procurement means that I think there are some perverse incentives at play. For example, if it costs a lot of money to make edits to the user interface, that is making somebody a lot of money. And they won't want to make it easy. They won't want to give the control to somebody else. There is going to be a perverse incentive there to keep the interface bad in the default position so that you can then pay them an extra however many hundreds of thousands to customize it.
So I started my research, and over time I've realized that there is the vendor issue. So they've got a system that they have and it's built, and they want to sell it with minimum R&D because it's, you know, that's their business model. And then I have to say that every single developer, NHS IT guy or girl, everybody involved in health who is not a clinician, I feel, wants to do good in the world. They want to support medicine, and they want to support clinicians in their professional duties.
Yes.
I genuinely believe that.
I think that's true, yeah.
But I think that what we're guilty of, as well as anybody else, because we can sit there and huff and puff and say, oh, this is absolutely terrible, I hate this computer, I'm leaving, you know, which, and people have resigned from jobs because of their computer system. But we also have a responsibility to try somehow to speak the developer's language, to say, we need a CRP. We don't just need a positive, an out of range CRP. We need a trend, but we don't just need it year by year by year. We want to see where the hotspots were for a high CRP. So we have to somehow find a language to help developers understand how we think. And it goes both ways. We've all been in coffee rooms hundreds of times and people storm in fuming and saying, that bloody computer. Let's forget about interoperability and crashing. I mean, that's, you know, I can't get my printer to work. I mean, that is what people are focusing on. But the real problem is, I don't understand my patient's story. He's coming in, I've got 10 minutes, and I'm spending the first 5 minutes scrabbling around, trying to find out if there's anything seriously, a serious liability or a clinical risk or something that I should know within the first 10 seconds. Like they've had a spleen out. Like they've had a spleen out. I need to know that bang on the start line. Otherwise, my entire consultation, A, for me, is just full of threat that I'm going to mess up. Secondly, for the patient, it's like full of disrespect. Like, don't they know I've been a patient with, I had my spleen out 22 years ago. Why doesn't he know that? Yeah. And then, of course, the level of the quality of the clinical care you can give as the clinician is way down from what it should be. And, of course, that, it doesn't reverberate around my trust or my department or my trust or my county or the UK. It goes all the way through research, epidemiology, procurement, everything. The global health system is affected by the EHR interface.
Yeah. And those interfaces, we've never really managed to get any, even some simple standardization in there. Like there was an attempt in the national project for IT to do this thing called the CUI, the Common User Interface.
Yes.
And it never really caught on because they paid Microsoft to come up with it. First of all, that was their first mistake. Microsoft essentially used a lot of the design themes that were already in Microsoft Office. So it had like the Common User Interface looked an awful lot like the Microsoft Ribbon, which people from the mid 2000s will remember as, you know, being the sort of the interface for like Word and Excel and stuff like that. So the ribbon, you know, is what it looked like. And if you use Emis Web, you know what we're talking about, because Emis Web really does ape that ribbon, that Microsoft ribbon, so much. It's like they copied it from Microsoft. And they were probably influenced a little bit by the Common User Interface, possibly. But then in 2019, the Common User Interface was abolished by Matt Edgar and not replaced. And that was another massive own goal, because we could have said, well, we're going to replace it with something better and have an open source framework. But that, even just a bit of standardization, like if the splenectomy information was always in the top right,
just sitting
of
there,
every clinical system you ever use, then it would be like, you know, when you get in a car, the accelerator is always on the right. Okay.
Yeah.
I don't think there are any cars that have the accelerator on the left, the clutch in the middle, and like, you know, the brake on the right. They don't do that incredibly dangerous reversing of some critical piece of the interface.
Yeah.
Could we have that in clinical systems? Like, that's what we want.
That year that I was in London doing my first EHR, I started sketching what I wanted my interface to look like on the bus, and they're really basic crayon pencil drawings of a patient history, and I did them on an A3 sheet of paper, and I took them to four deans of four medical schools. I won't name the medical schools, and I'll never forget one visit. I got to see the actual dean, and he said to me, he said, "Dave, we are in the business of saving lives, not drawing pretty pictures."
Wow.
And I thought, well, this is no good for anybody. And I then sent a cold email to the Royal College of Art. It's a leading design university, postgraduate design university in London, and you know, within a month the head of the information experience design department came to my hospital with his assistant, and he sat me down and we had a chat. I went for an interview and they gave me a full scholarship within 6 weeks.
Wow. I mean, and that's amazing.
Yeah. You know, and that's design for you, because design tries to link different disciplines to make sense and to make people disciplines communicate.
It's interesting that a non-medical Royal College is more interested in medical design, medical user interface, than any of the Royal Colleges. I mean, I've had lots of very close contact with at least 5 Royal Colleges, and none of them gave a shit. Honestly, trying to get, they all have this highfalutin attitude of we're here to save lives, and if you're involved in the computers, that you're sort of low life. Yeah, you're down the chain. And they don't understand that the computer interface it's making clinicians miserable. It's creating clinical catastrophes. It's hurting patients. And if we get every little improvement that we can get to clinical interfaces, will save lives.
I mean, I have a secret passion for airline, not disaster documentaries, but airline near miss or airline, you know, crashes and near misses. I love them. I'm fascinated by them. Yeah. And if every clinic in England had that kind of oversight, you know, we would be shut down.
There's a great YouTube channel by a Swedish guy. I can't remember the
Mentor Pilot. Petter, Mentor Pilot. He's beautiful.
Yeah.
I mean, we would not be in business.
Because exactly what you say, like just moving a lever in a cockpit, and there's a well-rehearsed World War II bomber, the way they moved the lever or something. It was in the wrong place. Yeah. And it wasn't easy to tell whether you were shutting down the engine or putting down the landing gear.
All right, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, those kind of near misses cause crashes. They get investigated and then they say, we must never do this again.
You'll never do that again.
Yeah. And we don't have that in clinical medicine. And I actually think patients would be shocked to realize how little national oversight there is on like the same cock-up happening again and again and again. I remember when I was in training, there was a series of injections of intrathecal vincristine, which means injecting the wrong drug into the spinal cord as a treatment for cancer. And it basically is fatal. And there's nothing you can do about it once it's gone in. The patient is alive and then they will be dead. And that happened several times. And then they made some changes to the syringes, so that it was literally impossible to connect the vincristine syringe to an intrathecal needle.
Interestingly,
that doesn't happen in other parts of medicine.
You and I are in the same era, and that, so having started this 10 years of this PhD, it took me, but that pump infusion safety thing, that was the beginning of usability for health devices.
Yeah. There's a really good video I'll link to, which I would recommend all viewers should also watch, which is called Designing Healthcare. Oh, I've forgotten the exact name of it, but it's by Professor Harold Thimbleby. And it's a brilliant video about, I think done by Gresham College, about making healthcare safer. And he actually does demonstrate and talks about some errors that were actually programming errors inside syringe driver pumps.
Infusion pumps. Yeah,
and the infusion pump essentially killed somebody, but the nurse got the blame. And I think it's too easy in healthcare to just blame the clinician, and we don't focus on the system that they operate in, either like the chaos of the system, the overwork. We don't focus on the user interface either. We tend to just say it was the clinician's fault, hang them out to dry, and we never do what the airline industry does, which is, you know, yes, pilot error. You know, pilot error is the last resort when you've ruled out everything else. And if the interface is consistently misdirecting pilots, then the problem is the interface. It is not train the pilots better. It's fix the interface.
Sure. But you talk about the CUI from Microsoft, because that came, you know, I know that CUI, and I know the the day it went obsolete, and I was in the middle of my PhD, and I was thinking, well, what do I do now? Because I'm now talking about something that is obsolete. Yeah. But if you look at the usability, the health usability, that they came from computer science. So all the stuff that was, all the heuristics, you know, the rules of thumb, the evaluative statements that you judge an interface or a website being usable or not usable, all they did was take the web usability heuristics and just convert them for medicine. So even at that point, they weren't getting our buy-in. And I don't think it's their fault. I also think we had a duty to say, let's sit down properly and tell you what we need. Yeah. But I think doctors or clinicians as a profession, as you say, are like, they should know what we want. But how can they know what we want when we've spent 5 years at medical school and done 20, 30 years on the coalface?
We're relatively inaccessible to them. So
we are totally inaccessible.
When you go to an NHS Hack Day, I remember the first time I went, and I was really excited to be sat next to a developer. I'd never done that before.
Yeah.
And it was like, I'm talking to a developer. It's amazing.
Yeah, developers and clinicians, not only do they not ever share the same physical space, they do not speak the same language. And that is as much, you know, it goes both ways.
Yeah. I mean, when the first time I went to NHS Hack Day and I was sat next to a developer and I was really excited, they were also similarly kind of feeling that they could finally talk directly to a clinician and get an answer instantly about you know, where should this button be and stuff. And what that tells you is that somewhere, whether it's deliberate or accidental, the system keeps us apart.
So
here's developers away from clinicians.
Here's my new analogy. Sorry, carry on.
Yeah, go for it. Yeah.
Here's my new analogy that I've just thought of. It is like if you're designing Google Maps or Zoom or Amazon, it is like an English person going to Paris and sitting down with a Parisian developer, and you get a hook and you start something going. It's like, oui, je pense que. But I think clinicians talking to developers is like going to an Englishman going to China. It's like, I don't know where to start. All I am is bloody frustrated. I'm in the country that I've wanted to visit for years, but this is too much. I can't do it. I think there is so much of a communication gap that it just doesn't go anywhere. And so everyone entrenches. The clinicians entrench. They say, this is rubbish. I hate this computer. And the developers entrench. And they say, we're going to do it like with a ribbon on top, because there is nothing really intrinsically wrong with a ribbon on top, but it's underneath that, deeper than that, that you need to go.
I think we could start a movement, though, and I'm all for starting movements. I'm already part of something called the Clinical Digital Manifesto, which is a movement about setting a manifesto for what the systems should do. And I'll put a link below. I won't go into it any further because I think it's kind of speaks for itself. But anybody who's clinical and wants to get involved should start there.
I've seen it. I love it.
And but further than that, like, we could bring back the common user interface, but we could do it right. The world has changed this year in that, you know, it is now faster and quicker than ever before to build software, and a clinician that knows what they want could easily build something like the Twitter bootstrap of clinical user interface. So a reusable set of components that have just the bits in that we want, and then you assemble them in the EPR when you're building the EPR.
So the best EPR I've ever used was in 2016, and it was an Access database that one of the consultants had built for HIV care. I mean, it was just fantastic. There was another one at the Royal Free, but I still want an interface that has clinical and developer collaboration in it, because the developers are super whiz kids. They do stuff that we wouldn't have a chance in doing.
If we could get clinicians and developers working closer together in the same room without the usual organizational sort of stuff that keeps them apart, all that the kind of anti-patterns that permeate the NHS organizations and the EPR vendor organizations.
Ah, well, yeah. Let's not even talk about EPR vendors.
Yeah.
So this PhD of mine at the RCA, it's taken me 11 years. Oh, I mean, I was working alongside it, but it's taken 11 years. And of course, I went from the discipline of medicine, and then I thought, right, I'll quickly learn UX, usability, UI, visual analytics, and I did. But still, it didn't work. And then I thought, well, I've got to learn visualization. So, you know, mm-hmm. So I did all that, and I submitted my PhD, and it came back with major corrections. And the examiners were like, this is too. We don't understand where you're coming from. You're either coming from medicine, or you're coming from computer science, or you're coming from visualization. But the language you're using just confuses all three of them.
Okay.
And one of them was really smart. He said he's retired, so he's an old, experienced design professor. He said, Dave, you're not trying to inhabit UX. You're not trying to inhabit UI, or visual analytics, or visualization, or computer science. It's even more difficult for you. You have to inhabit the gap that sits in between all of those.
Yeah.
And that's why you're struggling. And the one thing this I realized from this PhD is, because I've been to dozens of conferences, UX conferences, I love them, but they don't quite sit. UI conference, I love them, they don't quite fit. Open Air, the Open EHR, that was one of my favorite conferences.
EHR Aircon.
I love that, mainly because of the enthusiasm. But again, I came away thinking, oh, I don't quite fit there. And the bottom line for my PhD is, it's not UX, it's not UI. Everyone, the tagline for my PhD is that EHR, modern EHR, well, I say modern EHRs, but they all look like they were designed in 1990, but EHRs, contemporary EHRs,
yeah,
they are misspecified at the level of design. So everyone, the goal seems to be help clinicians do stuff, help them order tests, help them write a letter, help them whatever, do stuff. But my PhD, the call to arms, as it were, is design EHRs to help clinicians think.
Yeah.
And once you've got that base layer of how do I think about a splenectomy, and you know, then you can go downstream and say, right, help them order a full blood count, and then present the full blood count to a general practitioner in a different way to the way you present it to a hematologist, because a hematologist knows all sorts of shit that we have no idea about.
Yeah.
But yeah. Help us think, make sense of data.
That's a very interesting take that we need to rethink about how we specify an EHR. It isn't just a series of tasks. It's like, how does somebody think about this? There's a great book actually called How Doctors Think, which is
I've got it here. I mean, yeah. it is my go-to book for my thesis by that Montgomery.
It's interesting. It's aimed at patients, and it's kind of to teach them how to interact with doctors, because once you understand how doctors are thinking about your condition, it makes you able to be a better patient. And I think from a doctor's perspective, it's given me insights into like how my unconscious ways of thinking about stuff that the patient is not ready for, and it makes me able to sort of like step out of that to an extent, you know.
And that book, I could tell the listeners or the viewers, that book is, she's an anthropologist, and she spent years, she just watched doctors working. And I've got my thesis in front, 2005 she wrote it. She said, contrary to popular belief, doctors are not scientists. What we are actually is practitioners who use science. And that whole idea that medicine is this very, very concrete science that is black and white and linear, it's not true. We are practitioners, and the art is in the consultation.
Yeah.
And we depend very, very heavily on science. And the minute you realize that, you realize that you have to design interfaces in a way that is very specific to clinical practice. the secret is how to express that and communicate that to all the people involved in the HR design. And that is Epic, the vendors, and that is the coders, and that is the people who install it, and that is the visualization. It's the whole lovely, super skilled collective that designed EHRs. But we're nowhere near that collaboration at the moment.
No. And what we are is we're experts at pattern recognition. That's what medicine sort of boils down to, a lot of pattern recognition. Yes. And yet our systems, firstly, they're not very good at showing us that there is a pattern. So, in a GP system, if you want to look through all of the different full blood counts or something, you essentially have to step through them one by one, and you'll get a view of that one and then a view of that one. And there are some very rudimentary graphing that often is misleading.
Better than nothing.
No, it's worse than it's actually dangerous in one of the systems, because it will, if there's no result, it will plot the point of zero. This jumping around of the
orders.
Without getting into specifics, the point is that not only is the pattern display is bad, sometimes dangerous, but it's different in every system. And I think ubiquity is something that we don't yet even know to ask for, but that the accelerator should always be on the right. Ubiquitous interfaces.
I totally get that the ubiquity, but you have to get it right first, and then you have to make it common. So I'm just going to plug my PhD. The main contribution that I came to with this PhD was the concept of longitudinal narrative coherence. So longitudinal in terms of time, so temporal longitudinal narrative, the story, coherence. And it took me 4 years to realize that was the major contribution, because I'm a doctor and I've been a doctor for 27 years. And it was so bleeding obvious to me that I was like, well, there must be something else. And my supervisor said, No one has ever named longitudinal narrative coherence. And that I define that as obviously the coherence of a story, but without unnecessary clinician reconstruction of that story.
Yeah, I like that.
And on that note, you know, a lot of my research was feedback on prototypes from clinicians. And clinicians were saying things like, for the prototype, in just a few colored dots, I can see what the story is.
Yeah.
Whereas with the commercial EHRs, they were like, what's the story? What's the result? What's the date? What's the da-da-da? So the main practical output of my thesis is they're constructs, they're guidelines for a designer or a developer. And on that note about time, I'm just got it in front of you. One of them is temporal salience, right? Temporal salience. We all know what salience means, and I'll just read it out because I've got it in front of me. So there's a commitment to temporal salience, and it is this: clinical relevance. So this is a tool that a designer or a developer can read and say, oh, that's what a doctor wants. Well, that's what a nurse wants. Well, that's what a physio wants. And it is: clinical relevance is structured independently of chronological recency, right? Such that transient or persistent salience remain perceptually distinct and stable over time. So basically what you're saying is, I don't want to see year after year after year after year of a full blood count that is normal and look for the HB of 7 in 2023. I want, without touching anything, I want to see that in 2023 there is an FBC of 7.
Yeah.
So it's salience that is not based on time or chronology. It's based on clinical knowledge, clinical system. Yeah.
I think it is hard to code those kind of things. I think we're going to have to go some way alongside with them to actually help them code good stuff. But I mean, imagine
it's doable.
It's doable. Yeah, it's all doable. And here's an example of why it is doable, right? When you see an electrocardiogram, you can recognize the patterns on it, even though to people who have never been taught to read ECG, it is a completely meaningless wiggly line.
Yes.
And yet we can see all kinds of nuance in that. And experts in it, you know, real experts, cardiologists, can see unbelievable detail.
Unbelievable stuff. Yeah.
Why can they see that? Because it was standardized.
Yeah.
Because there is a standard for exactly how much deflection upwards or downwards means what. The placement of the leads, standardized. The rate of the paper flow, standardized. The size of the squares, standardized.
Yeah.
Everything standardized. And when you get that, you can show people a pattern, and anyone in any country, in any language, can read an ECG.
So you talk about not being specific, but can we just talk about the FBC for a second? Because the ECG is a great example. So I designed a working prototype that helps doctors think, and the FBC was my favorite because, and I never actually, after 27 years of practicing, never, I did know it, but it never struck me. The FBC is 14 parameters.
Mm.
Seven of them are about oxygen carriage. Hemoglobin, MCV, MCH, MCH, all those red cell things. Six of them are about defense, immunity, white count, neutrophils, lymphocytes, etc. Eosinophils, right? And one of them is about clotting, platelet.
Yeah.
But then we also order INRs, prothrombin times, clotting studies, right?
Yeah.
So actually some of those belong pattern recognition wise with platelets.
Yeah.
So I'll show you one day, but you can visualize the FBC as an inverted triangle of seven oxygens at the top, six defenses at the underneath, and then the platelet sits on its own. But you can just add onto the same line an INR, an APTT, etc. And the minute you look at that, because I'm so used to looking at that inverted triangle, I'm just like, oh, it's obvious they've got leukemia, or they might have leukemia.
No one talks about this. In the medicine world, like, there is a very small number of people who even have thought about this. A very interesting person to talk to about this is a hematologist called Wei-Kyong Wong, who...
Oh, yes, I know. You know Wei-Kyong from a long time ago. I might call him up, actually.
When he did a thing at an NHS Hack Day called Cell Counter, one of the first ones I was at, and basically it was to work around the counting system, which was like an abacus that they had to use. They were using like a £100,000 microscope and then this ancient tool. But in the process of doing that, started to think about the visualization of the parameters of the full blood count. And we don't have a standard like an ECG is a standard. So ECG is a standard for visualizing the electrical activity of the heart. If we had a standard for visualizing the FBC, then we would be able to recognize patterns of FBC derangement like from 100 meters away. Because like, if you just said, well, the HB is always this color and in this area, you could have a graph, and there would be, imagine if all the parameters were just one axis of a graph, like almost like a scatter plot or something like that, then there would be certain patterns of disease that would result in, like, all the dots are in the bottom left. That is myelodysplastic syndrome or something. You know, that if we had that, we would just, medicine would get so much better, faster, quicker. Ah,
that's right. So on the extreme end of the scale, you've got the FBC for the hematologist, but at the other end of the scale, because, you know, representing data over time is complicated, but it isn't rocket science. If all the FBCs are normal, you can aggregate all of that into a single green dot. In fact, even if there's an abnormality, you can aggregate all that data into a single red dot for that day or that time, and the clinician can be like, bang, fine, I'm happy, or let's look at that more. It's just so intuitive. It can be so intuitive, but it just no one's really, there's not enough of a movement to make it work, to make it happen.
I think it can be done. I think clinicians need to get more cocky. They need to be more outspoken.
Well, they're cocky enough, to be honest. I think that's half the problem. There's a weird automatic credibility and haughtiness about clinicians, because they're doing a good job, but so is a carpenter and so is a sparky. Like, we're all doing good jobs, but there's something about clinicians that is like, we're too busy saving lives. I think
That, well, that is funny enough. That's just come up in a previous conversation just an hour ago. Every clinician you ask to get involved in this stuff says they're too busy. And
well, that is also
it is true. Right. It's true in a literal sense that there is too much workload on clinicians to get involved. However, we it's something that has to be done to get medicine to improve. We need better user interfaces. We need ubiquity and standardization, and we're not going to get there by wishing idly and sort of generally for it. We're going to have to build those things.
But what I think a lot of clinicians don't realize is it's a lot of fun designing these graphics. It is fascinating. It's like, oh my God, look at that. Look at how a liver and bone profile look on screen. If you visualize it, it's a thing of beauty actually, because you can also mess around with other ways, you know, with an LFT or something, you can have another shape for an LFT, because when you order an LFT and a bone, there are shared common ALPs, and you know, there's but you can also, if it's abnormal, you can pop the actual number just to the left, top left, so you're not even, you see an abnormal dot for a Billy or an ALP, and you're not even having to click on to see what it is. It can just show you what that is. 166. It's a really beautiful thing to design. And I think that's what we need to get across to clinicians. It's a nice thing to do.
And I think that there is, there are ways of making the design connected to implementation, which I think comes through open source as well. So
I totally agree.
The prima facie example of this is frameworks like Twitter Bootstrap Foundation, DAISY UI, and things. These are frameworks of user interface prettification that are free and open source. And so when you see you know, something that's been built in them, they're often just a lot nicer than sort of raw HTML buttons. So it makes it easy for a web designer to implement good design. And if we had those, but specifically for medicine, then it would close the gap between, say, the academics who are publishing you know, like this, if you do a paper and publish it in the Journal of Medical Informatics or something saying, this would be a nice way to visualize FBC. But unless it goes further than the paper, like there's no point. You are wasting your time writing academic articles about how to visualize something unless you publish the open source toolbox
that
shows developers how to implement it.
I'm going to push back again. There is a on an interface, there is a UX layer, UI, UX, whatever you want to, you know. There's a UX level, a usability. There's a UX level, and I'm all for making that common. But I genuinely think that you have to do the deeper thinking. The epistemic. It's an epistemic layer. It's how doctors think. It's how physios think. It's how nurses think. You have to lock that in at a higher level or a deep level or whatever, because that is foundational. And then the UX on top of the, you can do whatever, kind of do whatever UX you want, but you need to get how we think in there. Otherwise,
I think that's true. I'd love to see Royal Colleges of Medicine, you know, the various Royal Colleges, there are 25, I think, in the UK. Yeah. They need to get more involved in this. And it's something I've been saying for years, that Royal Colleges, you know, best practice as code, they have to start publishing how they think as packages of publishable code, toolkits.
Do you know what we should do, Marcus? So this, my PhD is very heavily based on engagement from the British Association of Sexual Health and HIV, BASH. Mm. That's my national association, British Association of Sexual Health and HIV, and Beaver, the British HIV Association. So all the clinicians nationally were doing prototyping and talk alouds and feedback and stuff. And, you know, the Royal College of Physicians has just recently published an AI report, the state of AI. Have you seen it?
I haven't.
It's pretty good. Yeah. But of course, AI is the black box problem of not, you know, who knows what it's doing. So we as BASH we're in the process of writing a response to that document. And it is basically saying, you've got the data, you've got the AI algorithm, you've got the outcome. You need to involve the clinician, and the only way to involve the clinician is with an interface that visualizes, because visualization is important, that helps us, you know, the cognitive stuff for clinicians. So maybe we should do another response, you and I, or the digital network should do another response to the Royal College of Physicians. Because
I think it's right, because we haven't yet got to the point where we've got good user interfaces and good visualization of the medical story for clinicians. And yet we've got Royal Colleges quite happy to almost hand off the problem to AI and just say, oh, well, AI will tell us the problem.
Correct.
And it's not been bothered to do the work to make it work for humans.
Correct. And it's not just that they're not good interfaces. They are dangerous interfaces. Yeah. Every day at work, you know as well as I do, you look at even, especially the younger doctors who have been brought up on EHRs and the nurses and the HCAs, you walk right around and there's 10 clinics going on. And if you're in charge of the clinic that day, you're like, this could crash. This could not crash. I mean, obviously it crashes every day, but this could go seriously wrong at any point.
There's so many little issues like, when you get a SNOMED pick list and it's just alphabetical list of drugs. So that, you know, phenoxymethylpenicillin is next to phenoxybenzamine, you know,
because
why wouldn't they be? Like, exactly. That's the sort of level of risk we're running all the time because of absent thought processes. And I just think that Royal Colleges are well placed to get involved in this because they already have the credibility. They already have the membership. They need to get their clinicians to say, we are, I don't know, pediatric growth specialists. We think in this way. We want a visualization that looks like this. I want to see bone age. I want to see growth charts. You know, all of that stuff is, I mean, I've been doing that with the Royal College of Pediatrics, but we haven't gone really into the subspecialization.
Two things.
Yeah.
You're exactly right. It isn't design error. It is design neglect.
Yeah.
And that is as dangerous as design error. It is just neglect. Tied into that, we talk about doctors and nurses not being able to communicate. And the Royal College of Physicians is the body that represents physicians. And I think the leaders of the RCP, from the president all the way down to whatever, I also look at them more kindly now. And I do think they need assistance.
Yeah.
They need the tools. They need the language to speak because they must, if they're practicing, they must go home and think, I hate this system. But they literally don't know how to start speaking Chinese.
Yeah. It's interesting that in general practice, we have what you could probably safely argue that the user interfaces are slightly better.
By a country mile.
But that's actually a legacy of the work that was done in the sort of 90s and the early 2000s in the GP systems when we had user groups that were very active. And actually all the user groups have died off now. So there are no active user groups. I think the System 1 user group is just about limping along, maybe EMIS. But I know for a fact that the Vision user group, for example, disbanded over half a decade ago. And we've lost the clinical input into these systems and we don't have a clinical voice. And I think it will result in the systems just gradually getting less easy to use.
The foundational tenet of design is user-centeredness.
Yeah.
And it occurs in almost every other discipline. Look at fintech, at finance. The UI and UX they have entire departments dedicated to UX and fintech in finance. Bloomberg is a really good example of, you know, look at aviation. That whole thing, it just doesn't work. It just doesn't happen in medicine. And
yeah,
it's a mystery, isn't it?
It's insane when you think about the amount of money that's spent on healthcare technology. Where are the clinical user facing design jobs, for example? You know, there should be a job. They should be actively recruiting for somebody who is like you, somebody who understands clinical user interface, is a clinician, to work in design teams and make the best ever clinical user interface. Where are those jobs?
Can I tell you a little anecdote? A few years ago, because I was looking at job adverts, and one of them came up, and it was Epic, because it was a, you know, Epic is being installed a lot, and it was an Epic customer, user service manager or something, and there were lots of these posts going. And I looked at the JD, at the job description, and actually the job description should have been liability. Basically, the job description was, if a clinician comes and complains about something about this interface, minimize our damage. It was a damage limitation job description. It was fascinating, yeah. But the title was clinical support facilitator, but it wasn't. It was a damage limitation job, and that tells you everything you need to know about commercial EHR vendors.
Yeah. Well, I mean that's not surprising for me to hear, but it's also sad that that's where the state of the art is. And I know there is a solution to this. You know, we can do and build, we can build the Twitter bootstrap of healthcare technology and make a brilliant user interface that is intuitive, that guides and teaches, you know, to quote Larry Weed, you know, that the record should guide and teach, as well as presenting patterns in predictable ways. And I think, you know, clinicians deserve this.
The patient-oriented medical record. That was Larry Weed, wasn't it?
A problem-oriented medical
record. Problem-oriented medical record, yeah.
And that still hasn't really happened. We do have systems that can do problem orientation, but it's different in every system. And I think unless we start actually demanding ubiquity, we're never going to get any progress, because even if, let's say, one system is clearly the best system, let's say one system puts a lot of effort into this, makes it really good, still only going to benefit the patients and the clinicians that work with that system. And if that system isn't everywhere, then we're going to have poor care with poor interfaces, and we're going to have good care with good interfaces, and
why don't we put your digital health manifesto on a date with my epistemic integrated framework for design and see how they match? Because I think,
yeah,
I honestly think all these people who are deciding our futures and the daily grind, you know, when I leave work, I am exhausted, but 90% of my exhaustion is because I'm fighting and working around a difficult system, because I use that system 8 hours a day. And I genuinely think these leaders, they of course they need activism to fight and push back against them. But I think when we push back, I think we need to give them some help.
They need some way to get involved.
They need a way to get involved.
Lever to pull. It isn't easy, and I've spent 20 years in health tech now, finding out how not easy it is. But there are solutions, and we as a community can solve it.
We can solve it having really great days, you know, really great hackathons, really interesting conferences where, you know, you finish the day's work and you've seen some great presentations, you've met some really fantastic people, you've had a great dinner and you've had a great dance and you've had listened to a great band, and you fly home or you get on the train home and you think, I am contributing something to my profession and, you know, to the world. It's a great thing to get involved in.
Yeah, 100%. So I think that would be my sort of closing thoughts would be, if you're a clinician and you're frustrated with user interface, firstly, it's not you. Secondly, go to an NHS Hack Day or organise one. Help Anne-Marie. Three, join the Clinical Digital Manifesto. Go to the forum. I'll put all the links in the show notes. And four, read Dave's PhD.
Have to read my whole PhD. Just read the framework, because it will give you, instead of that horrible feeling of frustration and anger and resignation and I don't know where to start to fix this, I swear to you, you will read it and you will think, at last somebody has put into a few words what I need from my interface. You will feel better, more calm, as if someone is fighting your corner, because I think up till now, you must be feeling that no one is fighting your corner, or no one competent is fighting your corner. Yeah,
it's a confused sea, isn't it? It's just like everything is sloshing about, but there's no real progress in a particular direction. But I think that by grouping together into communities, yeah, we can actually make some progress.
Definitely.
So, well, thank you, Dave. It's been a super interesting session to talk to you about this. And I think there's got to be more sessions on this, because, you know, we're only really touching the surface of clinical user interface. I'd like to do a bit more of a deep dive. And so, I mean, it'd be brilliant to have you back on, and we'll go further into maybe one specific area of interface, get some graphics and show things.
But I mean, Marcus, yeah, just to also for me to end, this is so telling. Like, you know, we've met casually at conferences and things, but to have someone to talk to who gets me and my work,
it's valuable, isn't it?
Yeah. It's valuable because all my clinician colleagues, they get me and what I'm doing, but they are so in a different, they're so busy, and they are so, it's not their job to build their systems. Of course, one or two of them, or, you know, they'll be perfect and they would love to do it. But really, it's really nice to talk to you, because, you know, we're on a similar wavelength.
We speak the same language, yeah. And yeah, I think there's lots of other clinicians out there as well who get it.
I agree.
Part of my hope with this channel is to sort of publicize it and get people to be able to communicate, contact each other, and create a community around clinical design and clinical informatics that is less geeky and a bit more inclusive. You know, we get everybody involved.
I think all clinicians who would listen to this would get it, and I think the interested minority or significant minority would be just always useful, because that's what we need, is just clinicians with a bit of with a desire to make their working life bring a bit of delight into your work, a good interface.
Yeah, and it's no different to, you know, surgeons who design a piece of surgical apparatus. You have to be a surgeon to have the idea. You have to be a surgeon to take it to execution and try it out. Yeah. And I think clinicians getting involved in designing their own user interface tools is exactly the same process.
Yeah.
It has to be us. It is our responsibility. We can't delegate it to the manufacturers of systems. No. But you've got to get involved. And there's a lot to play for, as we've said. You know, the state of the art is quite poor. We've got to make this better. Anyway, Dave, thank you so much for being on the show. This has been really exciting and interesting. And I think, I'm fizzing with ideas already of stuff based on this. So thank you again. And to all the viewers, I'll see you in the next one.